Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty for Pastor Bill Lamore. Bill, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be hanging out with you and doing this. And you can call me Bill.
Yeah. From here on out, you're Bill.
All right. Perfect.
So I got to disclose out of the gate, we were supposed to do another interview this morning. And that one fell through. Bill came to the door to potentially use the studio and he wound up being one of our guests. So I love it when a plan comes together that you didn't even know you were making.
No, absolutely. That was just hilarious. I told my wife what happened. She's like, that's pretty cool. Some things are meant to happen. So I appreciate you taking the opportunity and looking forward to talking to you.
Yes, absolutely. So I know you're about to release a book that you've been working quite hard on, but I know your story goes back quite a ways to tie in the relevancy of where you're at now. So if you could, please take me back to like the late 80s, early 90s, Fort Lauderdale, and pick me up at that part of your story.
Wow. Well, that's a sort of a crazy story. Just, you know, having my mom start going to church and become a religious person, I kind of went down that path. But by 16, which would put this in the late 80s for me, I had really gone on a very different turn. And so as the late 80s shift into the early 90s, just hanging out with a lot of the local music scene, grew up on heavy metal, so that was kind of a big influence. Got into like industrial, punk, a lot of other different genres of music. And music was a big part of my life, still is a big part of my life. I love it. But that was really engulfing me. And drugs became a part of that season and that time of my life that eventually derailed me. But at that time, I thought I was still in control of that part of my life. I think a pivotal point was me at the end of a Ramones concert in South Beach. I walked out and I met this guy handing out flyers for the first show ever that they were going to have, Marilyn Manson and the Spooky Kids at the time. So I took a flyer from him. It was a funny story because he had a, back then there was no internet, nothing to market yourself, but he was a master sort of promoter even back then. He gave me the flyer and I called it, and it was a hotline telling all the things that are happening with the band. So I called and I left my information. He called me back and he asked for my address. I was like, man, do I give this guy my, I don't know. This guy is kind of cool, but kind of like a little weird. So I was like, why not? Just give him my address. And he calls me a few hours later and he says, hey, I go to the cemetery across the street from your house. And so it got a little weird at that point. But he described, go to, you know, three rows over, six back, whatever it is, and describes a plot that he left something for me there. It was the daytime, so I decided to go check it out. And I found it, and it was a plastic baggie. And inside of it were newspaper clippings of serial killers and just gruesome things. Underneath that was a decapitated Barbie doll. And underneath that was the very first demo for Marilyn Manson. And so I got that, listened to that, just started hanging out with those guys, becoming friends, hanging out at a lot of the early shows. That was fun, but I guess kind of progressing my story is I started hanging out with Brad a lot more, the bass player for the band, Brian too, the singer. But as I hung out with Brad, drugs became more and more of a common thing. And that eventually led to what I call sort of the culmination of the broken season of life, where it was a downward spiral and it went downhill quickly. Fortunately, things got better. But that, by say early to mid 90s, was a pretty dark season.
Well, prior to it getting dark, what do you think was some of the things about music and that type of expression in art that was resonating with you at that point?
You know, for me, I just grew up with, I love stories of all kinds. I love just whether it's Star Wars, whether it's comic books, whether it's novels, I love stories. And I think when you look at music, like heavy metal, it's kind of silly sometimes, right? I mean, it's like
it's fantastical for sure.
Yeah, and so I think I connected with that. Like my favorite band in the world when I was 6 years old in 1977 was Kiss. I had never heard any of their music, but I just saw that. I saw Gene Simmons, the makeup and the look. I'm like, those guys are the coolest people in the world.
Yes.
And so I just, like, something, the vibe. And then I listened. I'm like, and they seemed like not as heavy as they should have been to me when I listened, but I still liked it, but it was just different. So I just always connect. Or Iron Maiden is where I learned my best history. It wasn't from my history teacher in high school. All the history lessons and the stories and the songs and so forth. So I just connected with the music, and I think it was part story, part escape because it's something different than your regular everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's obviously when you're young and dumb, there's a lot of anger, a lot of emotions. And I think that that's tied up in there, good release for a lot of those things. So I just deeply connected to that music and appreciated it seemed to connect with me. Where a lot of other, I mean, I liked some of the pop music and different expressions, but it almost felt like that captured me. Like I felt seen, sort of, like I could connect. Again, as weird as fantastic and out there as it may sometimes be, I sort of understood it.
Well, and Fort Lauderdale, Miami, that area at that time was, well, not that it isn't now, but it was definitely its own little universe at that point, yeah?
Yeah, and there were a lot of really good bands. None that really made it huge. Like, I guess Manson would be one of the bigger bands that made it out of that area that got signed. But there were other bands that made it. There was a band called Tough Luck. They kind of had a documentary called Tough Luck, ironically. They never quite made it out there. Other bands got signed, major record labels. And Saigon Kick was one of those that kind of had a hit. And
yep.
But where are they? Just a lot didn't stick. A lot didn't have the longevity. But there was a pretty good music scene, like local clubs. And it was just a weird time in a crazy area, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, in that season. So there were a lot of good bands. Young Turk was another band that kind of had a record out on a major label, kind of didn't really go anywhere after that. So there was a lot of that. And there was the promise of a lot of bands kind of launching off. Obviously, it was no L.A. or a music hub like New York City like that. But there was a lot of talent that was coming out of there. So it was fun to be immersed in that.
Yeah, there was a lot of that underbelly of being so far south, so far removed maybe.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is. I mean, but there seemed to be a lot of creativity, a lot of bands that began to emerge. And again, some hit different various levels of success for whatever they defined it as. But as far as breaking out on a national level, there weren't that many. But there was enough to keep that area engrossed, entertained, and engaged. So it was fun.
So, yeah, you mentioned Brad, and I somewhat self-disclosed. I am a big Marilyn Manson fan, was from the mid-90s. I actually got tattooed by someone who tattooed Marilyn Manson when he had won a Battle of the Bands in Southern Florida.
Oh,
total by coincidence. So I do know some of that backstory, oddly enough. And I know that Brad, the Manson fans would know him as Gidja Gein, wrote a lot of those early songs. And he was a big part of that. And the reason why I'm touching on that and want to bring that up is because there is the part in this story in your arc where the art and this expression is a big part of it, but then the drugs and things start to take over. Talk to me a little bit about how the promise and the potential gets a bit skewed in that.
Yeah, so let's talk about Brad. He was a good friend of mine for a while. I actually knew him before he joined Manson, but then, and as I got to know Manson, they're like, yeah, we hired this bass player. And I was like, oh, man, it's Brad. So it was kind of like a cool thing and a friend. And he did, as you said, he wrote a lot of the music. And it wasn't just that he wrote a lot of the music. I think he wrote a lot of their culture, the look, the aesthetic that they ended up being known by in the early days, at least, was kind
of Spooky Kids era.
The Spooky Kids era, the lunchbox, that was something he picked up, the spandex with the cutoff jeans over them, that kind of look. That was him bringing that kind of into the band. So he added for a bass player a lot more than people would typically. He wasn't even a bass player. He was a guitar player, but switched to bass to join the band when that position came available. But it was fun watching him because I looked at him. I always knew he was going to be a rock star. He just looked like a rock star, acted like a rock star, kind of when he walked in a room. And so it's like, hey, this guy's going to be big. And you saw that happening. Like, if you were around at that time and saw Manson in those Battle of the Bands, you would see when they're on the headline, they're filling up the clubs. They're having all these people come. Like, they knew how to market and promote themselves. And the music was good. It was kind of taking some of the better elements of some of the biggest styles, fusing that, and they had a good draw. I mean, the concept title of the band, is, you know, as a fan, is kind of intriguing and a fun way to kind of juxtapose two ideas and kind of just stick in your skull a little bit. So it was neat watching the upward trajectory, but then at the same time watching Brad, who couldn't, and the inner working being a part of that with them in my own life, I didn't have a band, but had a life. And so, but watching our own lives sort of disintegrate through heroin, through drug addiction, was was hard. And I share some of this in a couple of the chapters of the book that I have coming out, my time with Brad, my time with Brian, Marilyn Gidget, for those of you that know them along those lines. But for me, I guess watching one of the hardest things with Brad, with Gidget, was when he actually got kicked out of the band.
Right.
Because of drug use. And, you know, for just a quick, for those that don't know, he entered rehab after an overdose, was brought back, and was in rehab. And I think it was like Christmas Eve or something like that, got a letter that he was no longer needed for the band, was kicked out of the band. And it was just this awful, dark period for him. Like he was, he recorded on the first album. That's his music, his recordings on there. And yet he was kicked off right before everything that he had worked hard for was fulfilled. So it was right. Just awful seeing that experience for him and what a blow that was for him.
Yeah, and is this like one of the first times in your life you're either by proxy or even starting to kind of firsthand experience what it's like when life has thrown these hard lefts?
No, you know, and I guess like...
Thank you for sticking with us. We hope you're enjoying the episode. We'd like to take this time to talk to our sponsor for this week, Tony Barrett from Barrett Realty.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate you having us on the show. Barrett Realty has been in business for 20 years, and we are a boutique real estate company. And I look forward to servicing our community with people that want to buy and sell property. I think it's very important that we're out there advocating for personal property rights. And we want to be the people that you select when it comes to buying and selling homes. So please, if you're interested in buying or selling homes in Manatee, Sarasota, or surrounding counties, reach out to us at Barrett Realty at 941-745-9999 or brmovesyou.com.
Again, we'd like to send a big thanks out to Tony Barrett, Barrett Realty, for sponsoring this episode and being an awesome part of this community. Please enjoy the rest.
So in my, and we'll have to talk because it's my book is weird. It's a lot about my life, but it's not a biography. So we should probably talk about that at some point because it's like who writes a biography when no one knows who they are,
right?
But so that's not that. But in my I do talk a little bit about, you know, when I was five, my dad died, and that was kind of like a gutting thing and experience. So there were other curveballs that happened along my lifetime. I think. You know, life, none of us comes out unscathed.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Right?
It's risky business.
It's risky business living. It beats the alternative, but it's not easy.
Right.
And all of us are broken in some way. Sometimes even from the time that we're born, sometimes it comes along the way as emotional, physical, you know, spiritual, mental, whatever it is. And we all experience that. So by that time, I had already experienced, you know, loss, grief, difficult things, gone through my own sort of depression, gone through my own addiction and watching things slip out. Like, so for me, I didn't have a real clear sense. Like, I wasn't going to be a rock star. I kind of looked the part back then, but I knew I couldn't play. I put a guitar in my hand. I could still play like Master of Puppets or something, but it's like just the intro. I'm pretty bad. I can't really play much else. So that was never the thing, but I was like, oh, what do I want to do? Writing was something that I wanted to do my whole life. Ironically, I'm only coming back to it now, but I did end up writing for music magazines locally with South Florida. I wrote Marilyn Manson's first interview for a local music magazine, did other things. So
very cool.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing, but a lot of that began to break down, like dropped out of college from President's List 4.0 one semester to all Fs because I just stopped going to class because I couldn't be bothered when you're in the middle of an addiction that's active like that to keep up doing things like homework, writing papers, going to classes. So I guess I had already experienced it in my life as well. But watching someone, it's just kind of a weird thing. You knew those guys or you knew the story. So it's weird to see someone, and maybe you've seen this in your life, that you were close to, friends with, and all of a sudden they hit superstar status or they break out in a big way. And then their whole life changes. They're off to the next thing. And you're not. And so that was sort of my experience in all of this. I'd spent a few years kind of helping along, just being stage prop, helping out different ways. Brian called me his minister of misinformation because our propaganda campaigns that we did with the band. But all of a sudden, so it was my loss was, oh, well, I had been spending time helping, but what have I worked on in my life? And, you know, what's kind of, everything's kind of, there's nothing. Brad's was, I worked hard on this dream. I was right there at the door.
Literally.
Literally at the door. And then he was at death's door. And then, boom, thank God he survived that time. But his dream died in that moment.
Right. So at what point does it come to you to start trying to do inventory on yourself?
So, you know, the criminal justice system has a way of helping you with that. I know a lot of people have different views on criminal justice and drugs and the intersection of the two. But I think for me, getting arrested was a pivotal time. I was hanging out with a woman that I had met. And we'd got some drugs, and they were real strong, and they caused her to overdose. And I was in this moment watching her turning blue and fearful, like, is this woman going to live? And I did the right thing. I called 911, and I was like, I'm probably going to get in a lot of trouble, but, like, I don't want this person to die. They saved her life. She was revived with Narcan, and praise God for that. However, I was arrested, taken in for felony possession, and that began an experience where I couldn't stay. Just because you're arrested and released on drug court probation and given a new chance, that's great. But if there's nothing changing internally in you and you still have this bad habit without any sense of hope or change or transcendence, I don't think the criminal justice system or even the fear of consequences is necessarily enough to motivate you to change your behavior and move in a positive direction. All that to say, I couldn't stay clean, and I ended up doing like 60 days because I violated my probation. And I thought, like, I didn't see a way out. Like, they tried acupuncture. I'm like, oh, apparently I was just using the needles wrong, right? I need to put them in my ears.
Yeah, right.
If I put them in my ears, I'm going to be okay. But yeah. I tried a lot of different things. And it was finally, my mom, she's a single mom. I told you my dad died. She got remarried, but they're kind of duds. Her husband now is great. So yeah. For record, but early in my life growing up. And so she became a Christian, and she was sincere, and she wanted the best for me. As I said, I was going to church with her when I was younger, but when I got arrested, she says, I'm only going to bond you out if you will go and enter this program. It's a Christian program. And so it's like after a few days, I'm like, I gave up. I'm like, yes, I'll go. I'd love to go to this program. Yeah. And so I went.
And how old were you at this point?
22 the first time. And it took a couple years. It took me a few times of going back because honestly, I went in with the wrong motivations. I wanted to just maybe clean up for a little while, get myself back together, and then do what I wanted to do. I wasn't there for what their centerpiece is sort of the spiritual side. Mm. I wasn't that interested. But over time, I really hit that fork in the road. And I remember one day looking, because places like that are always in one of two places. They're in the hoods or the woods. Because most no one else wants them right in their neighborhood.
So yeah, it's right.
But this one was in the hood, and I look outside, and there's drug deals, there's prostitution, like all the crazy life you look on and you look out the window. And it was kind of like a light comment. It was kind of weird, but it was a moment where I realized I have to choose. I could choose to kind of go back out to that window, to the drugs, to the shadiness out there, or I can move into the light that I'm hearing about. And I just kind of felt it was this weird moment. Like, I don't know everything about God, but I'm going to make this choice and make that connection. And I wish I could tell you from that moment on, it was just peaches and cream.
Right.
But it was a pivotal moment. It was a defining moment. And at that moment, I changed. I became a Christian, which is funny because ironically, I had made fun of. Even one of the side project bands with Marilyn Manson I came up was a fake Christian band we made. And so it was just like eating a lot of humble pie, coming back to this thing I had pushed back hard against my entire life.
What were those moments like?
Of realizing you're kind of...
The humble pie parts of the show. Because I have to imagine that in your time with the Making a Mockery or the side project band or any of that stuff, you had to have some conviction to that, even if it was just just to poke the bear.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is, so there's obvious flaws in religion, right? You in Christianity and church, just like in most things, you can find obvious flaws.
Sure.
And the most obvious flaws are people.
Because I was just going to say, there's people involved.
Because there's people involved. And so it's like, that messes up everything. So, for example, when I went to church when I was young, there were some really cool people. Like, actually, now that I look back at it, genuine, generous people. But there were some people that were also shady, seedy, judgy, all kinds of things. And I used those, you hit a point, to become an excuse where I want to reject all of this because I might point to certain people. But you kind of, as you step back eventually, start to realize, well, maybe the reason they should be in church is because they're that way and they need the help to grow and transform. And maybe they haven't been going that much longer than you. And you're assuming that this is a product of 5-10 years of Christian faith when really they might be brand new to this themselves. Or maybe they never really took it seriously and they're just showing up because of whatever reason. So I guess it made me, the humble pie was forcing me to look at why did I want to push back from it? What was there that I didn't like? And it was some of the hypocrisy. It was some of the judgmental nature, that because when I started growing my hair out and it's like people talked about that, it's not really a big thing now, but back then it was, you know, kind of weird. It was talked about. And I think a lot of those things were what my criticisms were based in. Some of it is, you know, when you are a person of faith, there's things that you're supposed to now live by and aspire by. And I didn't want to do that. So it was partially rejecting some of that and using certain things as excuses for that. So I think I had to walk through, to your point, about what were some of the objections, which one were valid and maybe I need to kind of keep an eye on, and which ones were more excuses.
Right, right, right. Exactly.
Because I think in anything, we have to justify our position. Whatever we end up as a Christian, Jewish, Muslim, atheist, agnostic, you need to defend it even to yourself. Even if you don't get on a podcast and talk about it, you need to be able to say, well, how can I stand behind this? And what is it that justifies my position, so to speak? So it was kind of undoing some of those things and saying, okay, well, why had I pushed back? So that's a good question.
So when you first come into contact with the innate judginess that is part and parcel, at least in some corners of faith-based groups regardless, and the hypocrisy that is to some degree part and parcel of it too, because no one's perfect and, you know, we can't bat 1,000. How are you reconciling that in the onset with your old frame of mind that wanted to reject those things and now your new frame of mind that's trying to provide you some new freedom?
So I think part of it is recognizing where I was at the time. When I was coming out of a drug addiction, I was in a facility that dealt with drug addiction as a residential person. So you're not really the upper echelon in society at this point. You know what I mean? You don't have much to stand on and puff your chest out and say, hey, look at me. So you there's a little humility baked into your existing condition that you're in a place like that. So they brought us to this church called Calvary Chapel, Fort Lauderdale, big church out there. And we'd show up in a bus. And what's funny is we always tried to hide. We'd tell the driver, this guy Ponch, he was a resident too. We'd say, take us to the back because we don't want people to see us coming out of the van because they're going to associate us with this Calvary House place.
And the judgment will ensue.
The judgment will ensue. So he pulls right up to the front entrance, slides the door open, and as we're getting out, starts honking the horn to draw attention to us. And we're like, you know, lurching out like the misfits, kind of piling outside of the van. And it's just like, okay, so thanks a lot, Posh. Yeah. But it was kind of like, it's one of those things. It's a humbling moment where you're like, okay, I can't pretend. I can't put on airs. So you go inside. And immediately, and I'm getting to answer your question, I look around, you see everyone seems put together, perfect, and you just immediately assume that everybody knows you're the misfit, they've got it all together, and at best they're putting up with you, right? You're in this place. And it took me time to realize that even the people that looked pretty and put together, the beautiful people, if you will,
yeah,
they're not all perfect and put together. Underneath, there's brokenness in every single one of them, just like there's brokenness in me. Now, mine was more obvious, by looks, by behavior than other people's, where it might be deeper, it might be more shoved down into the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, one of the reasons that I wrote this book is to help people press in, no matter what they look like externally, and press into those broken pieces, take it out, deal with it, to move to healing, transformation, and move beyond it. Because so many of our lives, we push that stuff down. Sidebar. Back to what, to answering your question, is I saw all this and it just hit me one day. It's like, wait a minute. They don't think of me, most of them, the same way I think of myself. A lot of this judgment is my projection onto them of my own view of myself and how they're probably interpreting. And the truth is, they probably couldn't care less. I mean, like, they probably didn't even notice me.
Right.
But in my mind, you're judging me, all these looks and this and that. And so it took me time to realize they're just as flawed and just as broken as me. So even if they are judging me, what's that coming from? What happened in their life to put them in that place, to put them in that position? And my conclusion was, it wasn't the gospel. It wasn't what Jesus taught. Jesus didn't teach that. Jesus didn't teach, like, you know, judge not lest you be judged. And yes, there is judgment, to so to speak, but the idea starts with a self-examination of judgment, growth. And then when you judge, it's more of, hey, God's job is to judge in terms of verdict. My job is, you know, when we judge as people, we make judicial estimates of people. We evaluate, so to speak. But my job isn't to condemn. That's to forgive. Those are, you know, we are called to forgive. But my job is not to condemn. That's God's job, to issue judgment upon another human being. That's not my job. And so I think for some, it just hit me after a while. Like, number one, I'm projecting onto them what I think about myself and assuming that that's coming back to me. And maybe secondly, if that is coming from them to me, then there's something broken in them too. And shouldn't they be curious? Because to me, it's very clear that there's broken things going on in my life. But shouldn't they be curious about some of the broken things, even if they're going to church, that are still happening in their lives and how God may want more for them?
Yeah, and that's a very operative thing. There's a gentleman that I really like called David Goggins, and he says that everybody is effed up. Some people just do a better job of hiding it.
Yeah, it's true.
What do you think is the propensity of people in faith-based situations to still have that need to hide what's wrong with them instead of trying to, like you said, embrace it, try to share it, maybe learn together? Why do you think we have this need to protect this ego, for want of a better way of putting it, even in those types of circumstances?
That's a great question. There's a lot of things. One is the culture of any particular church. Culture is a powerful thing. Culture of a business, culture of an organization, a culture of a church could be, or could even be assumed to be, that you've got to have your stuff together.
Mm.
You have to have it together if you want to be considered a good member in standing. You want to be considered a leader in a church or a faith community. And so in those cases, we may have to pretend, or not have to pretend, we may think we have to pretend in order to keep up position and appearances, where if you actually, again, this is where I say the difference between cultural expectation and, say, for example, scriptural, the Bible says, confess your sins to one another. Now, why does it say that? Because it assumes you will sin. It assumes you will fall short. Now, it doesn't make excuses for that, but the idea is, in sharing with you, when I confess sort of my sin to you, it's not in the terms of like a Catholic priest where I'm confessing to you for forgiveness. It's bringing something from the darkness to the light. And when you bring it into the light, it loses its power over you. Going back all the way to addiction, you hide stuff like that. As long as you can, you hide addiction. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be substance abuse. It could be gambling, pornography. It could be drugs. It could be spending. It could be eating. Whatever it is, we tend to hide these things because they bring shame. They bring, just reproach to us. And so we don't want our names, what we think of our names and reputations, attached to those things. So we hide. But the moment you bring those things from the darkness into the light, it loses power. Funny, back to your buddy there, Marilyn Manson. I know you're a fan. I lost touch with a lot because I knew his old stuff, but I recently listened to one of his new singles, "Sick as Sick as Your Secrets," or something, "As Sick as the Secrets Within."
Yeah.
The whole idea is something they'd say in 12 Steps, is that, you know, you're as sick as your secrets, and the idea is you keep these things inside of you, and they contaminate you. It's like they are radiating and just kind of giving you bad things. But if you bring it out into the light, then it loses its power. And I guess for some people, while that is so available, it's part of what I want to help people do. But what the reason that would hesitate is, if I bring this out, what's Eric going to think of me? What's Seth going to think of me? How will I be judged and interpreted differently? Like even now, like this is many years in my past. But when I bring it up, people have a very different impression, for good or bad, than they did before they heard my story. I'm at the point where I don't care, because I look at it and say, it's not just my story, it's God's story. He took the brokenness, brought it through a season of redemption. And look, I'm still broken. We're all still broken in places. I don't mean it to say, hey, I'm a perfect product. Yeah. You are now interviewing. But my point is, if you go from where I was to where I am, it's like you could see there's been great healing, great transformation. There's still miles and miles to go. But the point is, you hit a point where you have to be willing to release that. And if you can be bold enough to reveal yourself, and you shouldn't reveal all of yourself to everybody, right? Because there's some things that are meant for just close friends and confidants. But if you get to the point where you can share the arc of your story, and so people know who you are and so forth, there's great, great power, healing power. But it's the fear, I think, that keeps people back. Will I be judged? Will I be interpreted differently?
Right. And we recently spoke to a woman who runs a podcast called The Endurance Podcast. And one of the operative things I started to try to touch on with her, and maybe you can shed some light on your own perceptions of this, is the fork in the road where we feel comfortable enough to be the person outwardly that we see ourselves as inwardly. And I think some of that is what you're talking about, the beating ourselves up, the projecting our own insecurities. But I'm a little bit curious about how you feel about cultivating the self-assuredness to not constantly be hoisted by that scenario.
So I think there's a couple things. One, the person within sometimes needs to change. So you look at it and say, okay, I am who I am, but do I want to be the person I am, so to speak, or do I want a more refined, healed version of me? So I think that it's starting where you are and being that, but then I think you constantly need to analyze and say, number one, who do I want to become? What do I want the next evolution of Eric Bill to look like, or whatever it is? And then where you are, it's just facing the reality and say, okay, but this is, you know, there's other parts of us that aren't broken, that we are pretty clear on, hey, this is my true north, this is my identity. And then it's coming to the place of, I guess, it takes some boldness, right, to be able to just say, I'm going to be on the outside who I am on the inside. There are other parts that I want to change. Maybe I'm not going to present those forward facing,
right,
but the parts of me that are pretty clear and core to who I am, I'm going to be. I guess part of it is having confidence in something part of it is boiled down to, am I confident and comfortable in who I am and what's basing it? So for me, there came that point where it's like the rug was pulled under my feet. I didn't know who I was. And all of a sudden I'm a Christian. And I didn't know who I was for a little while, because like you said, everything turns, you're facing some humble pie, and it's like, oh man, like I don't know. I don't feel at home wearing my Dead Kennedys t-shirt around anymore, or whatever it's like, but I don't know who I am. I don't want to wear like a Petra t-shirt. I don't know, who am I? Who is this person? So it's figuring out who you are, doing some self-evaluation, and I guess getting to that place of knowing what your true north is, because there came a point where I became a Christian and I felt confident saying that, like, I was wrong. I looked at it wrong, or I was just wrong about some things. And
I don't mean to cut you off, but do you look at it as a black and white dichotomy of right and wrong? Or is there any parsing of it as these were just choices that didn't work for you?
Well, I think both. I think there's like right and wrong. Like, for example, when I outright dismissed, like when I had moved from a point of agnostic to atheist, I feel like I was wrong to me, that I was wrong, that there is a God, that there is something. I was incorrect about that. Now, the shades of gray, the nuance definitely came with how you interpret what does it look like then to be rightly connected to God? What does it look like to live out my faith in a community of other people also trying to do the same? What does it look like in different ways? So I guess just some funny experiences with this, like along the way, I went back to, you know, Fort Lauderdale and Squeeze, and I ended up, after I became a Christian, I walked through the club one day just to kind of, I don't know, I knew I didn't belong sort of any, like, it just felt like weird because I wasn't drinking, I wasn't drugging. I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing here, but I'm just traipsing around. And I ran into our old buddy, Brad, and like, you could tell he'd been thinking about this. He's like, hey, Bill, I heard you found Jesus. And I said, yeah. And he says, man, I didn't know he was lost. And he just starts cracking up. And I was like, okay, you set me up for that one. And it was, we're laughing about it. So it's just kind of like, it's, there's some of that humble pie because he's someone I would have probably mocked someone else with like that before. But now I'm on the receiving end of that. So it's, some of that is nuance. Some of that is becoming more comfortable, again, with who you are. And it's just perceptions. And so, for example, our church, when people would come, the church we started a church in West Hartford, Connecticut, and got to pastor it for 18 years. It was a great blessing to be a part of doing that. And it's something I never, like if you knew me back then, you never would have expected. The Bill's never going to do that.
That's awesome.
I never would have wanted to do that. And yet, so here I am. Like, and what, but one of the things we said is that from the beginning, no perfect people allowed. Like you can't, if you're perfect, we don't want you here. You can't come. You don't belong, you know? And so it was kind of a joke, but it was a funny way of saying, hey, come warts and all, come with your hangups, your issues, even your doubts, your insecurities, your dysfunction, and come and learn. Let's learn and grow together. And I think that part of that is some of that, because some people are black and white about issues they don't need to be black and white about.
Right.
And for example, like theology on certain issues, doctrine in certain areas, I think there are black and whites. If you are a Christian, there are certain things you just believe, like salvation through Jesus. Like there's certain things that you believe. There's other things that you come, like when you're young, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was younger, I knew everything, right? I had it all figured out.
Of course I did.
Yeah, right? I knew everything. The older I get, the less I know. And the more I realize, man, maybe I shouldn't have been so entrenched in this particular position, how the end of the world works, what the book of Revelation is. Feel like there's a bunch of things that you just can keep in an open hand and say, hey, over a cup of coffee, this might be interesting to argue back and forth over, debate, discuss, but I'm not going to break relationship with you because we have a just opposing viewpoint on a certain thing. We'll just say, hey, interesting. You see it this way. I see it this way. At the end of the day, I love you. I care about you. You're my brother in Christ, whatever it is. And so I think that part of it is learning that there is room for nuance. And there's also times there's hard lines, right? In life, it doesn't matter if you're a Christian or not a Christian or a faith person of faith or not. You probably have hard lines in your life of this. I do this. I don't do this. I am this. I'm not this. There's some areas that are maybe more malleable, more maybe more gray, but we all typically have some hard lines somewhere.
Yeah, I'm somewhat unique in that I honestly don't have too many of those outside of my own personal regimens of my own self-care. And that's partly because of the person I used to be that no one would believe. So I think we have that in common. But I'm a little bit curious, or I wonder if you can kind of paint me the picture, kind of bridge the gap between when you're getting off the bus and the man is blowing the horn and you're feeling like odd man out in Fort Lauderdale, to the point where you get enough wind behind your sails or you're starting to feel less broken in enough ways that you start your own church and start to find the strength and the power and things within you to help other people.
No, that's a great question. So obviously some time went by. I got cleaned up and moved out of the program, and I went into the business world, and I was an operations man. I worked my way up from customer service to an operations manager, and I honestly thought that that's what I was going to do. But I felt this strong pull at the same time to start going to Bible college while I was working full-time. And all the guys in there, the gals, be like, I'm going to be a missionary. I'm going to be a pastor. I'm going to be this and that. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just supposed to be taking these classes. And it was interesting to me, studying theology, studying the different things. But I was learning business practices and kind of operating in that wheelhouse. Funny enough, 4.5 years later, after I graduated this program called the Calvary House, there was a crisis. The original director had left. Several things happened. They were almost ready to close it down. But the church, it's a mega church, Calvary Fort Lauderdale, I talked to them, and they said, would you like to come run it? And so 4.5 years after graduating, thinking I'm going in a business track, it's like, welcome back, Cotter. It's like,
yeah, put me in, coach.
Put me in, coach. And so, like, and they said, look, I don't know what's gonna, if this is going to work. You got a year to turn it around because it has really gone into a place of disrepair. So we put an ad hoc team together of some guys and gals, and we just kind of said, how do we restructure this so that this ministry has a chance to survive? And it did, and it thrived. And so I was there for 3 years. And it was cool because I got to, in a sense, help save a ministry that helped save my life. So it was kind of a very rewarding thing.
So awesome.
Yeah, and that, it was like, wow, it's cool because addiction by its nature is a very selfish thing, that you're destroying yourself, but you're destroying everyone around you in the process.
And you somehow can't see any of it.
You can't see it at the time. You're like, hey, what, I'm the one with the problem. You should feel bad for me. Like, so you're kind of delusional in the moment, right? But over, you wake up and like, oh, you got a lot of I'm sorries and amends to make later on, right? But so anyway, so time goes on. And then my friend in Miami asks me to come and be his executive pastor, which is funny. So God's taken me in redemptive circles. First, he takes me back to this place. Miami's where all my old pharmaceutical distributors used to be, where I'd go with Brad and others and go down to Miami. So now I'm going back to be an executive pastor at a church. A couple years later, I felt called back to my home state of Connecticut to start a church, because Connecticut, New England's a very non-churched area. And just time went by, and I realized that through the business skills that I had learned, along with sort of the theology of Bible college and the practical ministry, it fused together. And we got inspired, we got a vision, and moved in. Me and my wife and one daughter at the time, we got three now, came and started a church. And we worked hard, but God did amazing things. And the church grew from the three of us to, at the peak in our time there, over 600 people coming on Sunday mornings, which in New England's a miracle. Like, I know here that's, oh, it's a cute little church, but in New England, that's like a wild thing. And so it was super fulfilling to be able to be a part. And the entire time I kept thinking, how do we create an environment where people like me, as that kid that would have come in and feel ashamed, would feel comfortable coming in and doesn't feel judged? And I guess part of the way you do that is you share your story.
Yes.
This is my story. This is who I am. And right away, you know, some people are going to judge you for that. But what you've done is you probably have them self-remove themselves, because they're not going to really fit in too well if they're going to be super judgy. And then it helps accept other people that come in because they have a story too. And they look at it as a sense of shame. But I look at it as, you've got a great story in the making. You're in your heavily into your broken phase. But man, what about when you move to your sort of transformation healing phase? Like, it's not the end of your story if you keep moving. And so this, and it's so funny. Now I look at that and say, wow, that's sort of the arc of the book that I wrote, is a culmination of all of these things that I've learned along the way of wanting to help people and doing it in ministry environments, whether it be a recovery ministry, whether it be a church, and now saying, hey, I'd like to share this with other people because this is my experience. I don't know it all. I don't have it all figured out. I'm not the pastor expert that can come to you and just give you everything you need to know about everything, but I have a story. And I think stories are powerful. And again, I go back all the way to, I love story. And so it's interesting to look at your own story and say, can that be a help to anybody?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a good point. You're never lost if you keep moving. And sometimes that can be a really hard thing to tell yourself. Mm. And regardless if you're coming from places of addiction or other such demons, or you just have what looks like a normal life on the outside, but you're really feeling rudderless within, what do you think are some of the operative things that people tell themselves and can do to get to the point where they no longer feel rudderless, or just like they're moving in a direction for the sake of moving, and start to feel like we're moving with a specific direction?
So I have to take it from my framework. For me, that was a reconnection to faith. It was absolutely, I needed to know that there was something, someone, some opportunity for transcendence, some opportunity for healing. And for me, that became my true north. And when I say I believe Jesus, I'm going to follow Jesus, that became my transformative moment to move back into that place. But to try to take that, because I understand that's not everybody. So
right.
What's the framework for someone that says, well, I don't know that I believe that or I don't believe that, then what do you do? I think, okay, the first thing is, well, look at yourself. What are the broken pieces, and being honest and not, because I think that a lot of times we color things, we shade them. We're the best at lying to ourselves, and we don't have an honest, sober look at that person in the mirror. And I think part of it is taking a look, stopping. If it's a vice that's covering it, pull that away long enough to look and say, yeah, these are broken and this is bad. Confront the brutal reality of your life, but then say, what could this look like in a different way? If I were to begin to work on healing these places, seeking help, whether it be through therapy, through physical, whatever the brokenness looks like, it's obviously different for every single person. But what are the practices that would help me move from where I am to where the ideal is? And this is where I think it also requires some vision in life, some idea that you can get to a different place. For me, that was also wrapped up in faith. It's like, wow, through that, I not only have a future eternally, but right now I can make a difference with my life. And so that changed some of the things that I wanted to do, from what do I want to accomplish in business to how can I help people. So for people, that's going to be a different thing. Like, where are you right now facing that reality? Where do you want to be? And then asking yourself, what are the steps or sort of healing practices in a lot of cases that are going to get me to that place? And again, so in the book I've written, I walk through my broken journey. And it's like the first quarter of the book. I walk through the redemptive journey. That's the second quarter. But the second half is for everyone else. You ever read any Patrick Lencioni books, like Five Dysfunctions of a Team? He's a business guy. So half of his book, he writes like a fable, so to speak, like this is what a business dysfunctional or thriving could look like. Mm-hmm. And then he lays out the second half. These are the principles, sort of thing. So in my mind, the way I've looked at it is the first half is kind of like that, except the fable's my story. It's my real life. It's like what happened. And then the second half is, these are the practices that can help you grow and move from brokenness to healing, to wholeness. In some cases, they may be too spiritual, if you will, for a person that doesn't yet have a faith in Christ, although it explores what does that look like, how do you explore that? But in other cases, it's absolutely not. Any person could take, like, how do you move from things that hold you back, like toxic shame?
Well, and this is actually what I want. This is the question I really want to ask you, because you said the brutal honesty, the taking a look in the mirror, and that's another David Goggins thing, the accountability mirror. I'm huge on that. I am one of these people that doesn't have a problem with self-examination. My problem was not unlike a lot of people, where I would beat myself up too much. But then the other end of that coin is the people, like you said, that can't have that honest discussion with themselves at all. What am I not doing that's in service to me right now that I could change?
Mm-hmm.
I'm very curious that is a thing people are afraid of. That brutal honesty to say to yourself, hey, I'm doing X, Y, and Z. I could do this better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious for people, and I have this from an outsider's perspective, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be that faith-based people can do that because of that thought that I'm protected for forever and ever, amen. I'm playing with house money, so to speak. I should be able to be honest with myself because I'm just here to be the best me, and I'm just playing with house money, and that's my real true goal. But for the rest of the people who maybe aren't faith-based, or their faith isn't that strong in them, and they have to come to look at themselves, warts and all, and then have that crossroads of, am I going to go out in the world and try to hide this, or am I going to own this right now and go out in the world as somebody new? I'm curious what your thoughts are on that operative moment where you have to first be honest with yourself.
I think one of the biggest things so we talked about fear gets in the way, shame can get in the way.
Right.
But one of the things that gets in the way is comfort. And if you think about it, we will hide whatever we can hide, and we will gloss over the things that hold us back and not do the things that move us forward as long as we are comfortable. We are comfort creatures, and so we thrive on it. And so if I can maintain a life that's maybe not an exceptional life, but I'm comfortable enough, I have my little work, I have all these problems, but I can numb it out through enough television, enough music, enough drugs, enough alcohol, then we can stay comfortable. But you have to come to a place of discontent, of discomfort. And so in my case, it was again, brokenness. It was, you hit a point where with drugs, for example, that's usually not a sustainable one. Like that's such an extreme that it'll kill you or bring you to your knees, to the point where I need to do something different. And so as funny as it sounds, I'm almost glad in a sense that mine was that extreme, because it forced a fork in the road. Like, you know, in right. your heart of heart, you don't have to be that smart to realize this isn't sustainable.
Right.
You may not know what to do about it, but you realize I can't. But even for the alcoholic, where it's a lot more socially acceptable, they can in their minds think it's sustainable for a lot longer than it is. Or
right.
other people can say, I can, through enough video games or tea. And again, there's nothing wrong. I'm not judging any of those things. I'm saying when we use those things to escape, and I did that a lot of years of my life, and just not deal with it, then we just stay status quo. So I honestly think something needs to shake up the comfort. Something needs to shake up the sense that everything is fine. And we almost have to hit a place of brokenness. And that can look different for everybody. I might be more stubborn than you, and I might have to get hit a lot harder to change. I'll give you an example. You know, I talked a little bit beforehand about career change. So this year, I'm in a place of, after we left the church, it's like, okay, we were there, and long story about what brought my wife's health that kind of brought us back to Florida away from the Northeast. But it left this conundrum, because I thought we were going to stay with the church until I retired, and then maybe we'd move back and hang out at the beach or whatever.
Right.
But all of a sudden I've got another, you know, 13, 15 years to work, and I'm not doing that anymore. So what do I do? And I got bored earlier this year. And so I went out and I started doing a sales job just because it was like something to do. And it was a sales job I had done before. I was 6 weeks into this thing. A woman pulls in front of me. I'm going 50 miles an hour. Car crash. My car's destroyed. If you saw the pictures, you'd marvel. And I walked away from that, like, with just some minor hand injury, neck injury. But as soon as I walked out of that car, I knew, I'm like, this job's not for me. And it's not like I would say that in every situation, but it was like, I knew, it was kind of like, this is my Jonah moment. I've been running and I've been trying. I want to be comfortable because I like being busy. I like being productive. I don't like sitting around.
Yeah.
I like doing stuff. And so this was something to do, but it's like, okay, but that's not. And so what happened is that was very brokenness that disrupted my comfort. And then it had me pursuing, okay, well, what are those things? And that eventually led to, a few months later, starting to write the book and kind of say, okay, well, these are some of the deeper things. And what if I died in that moment? What would I have regretted not doing? So it's like, I guess you can create your own moments, right? If you could sit down and say, if I were to die today, what would I, and I knew I was dying like in the next hour, what regrets would I have? I guess you can force an exercise. Maybe you don't have to come to
that brokenness. Well, this is the Stoic practice of memento mori.
Yeah. Yeah. So go through that exercise, right? And then begin to evaluate. So you can do that. I think just most people don't until they hit the wall.
Yeah. We live in a weird time, seemingly, where we're disincentivized to do that. You know, yeah. It seems like we're almost rewarded to try to be the best actors we can be.
I think that's right. And again, all the things we talked about, it's uncomfortable to take off the masks, to lower the guards and be real with who you are, even to yourself. And I think that's one of the biggest problems is self-deception. We're so good at fooling ourselves. We lie best to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when we can wake up and recognize those, then we can get to those places of change and transformation. But again, it's usually the car crashes, not always literal, hopefully, but the figurative car crashes in life that we recognize and evaluate. Unfortunately, I'd like to hear from your take on that. Does it take a car crash? Does it take a pivotal moment like that? Or is it like through these Stoic practices, can you just create that?
Well, and that's one of the things I'm very curious about and I like to ask people about. You know what I mean? Because it's either pushed by a pushed by pain or pulled by a purpose or vice versa. I don't know.
Yeah.
One of the two. I'm not entirely sure. And obviously I'm not entirely sure, but it is one of those things that I do like to ask people about because it does seem to be infinitely idiosyncratic how people experience that. You know, you get close to it, you run away, or you get close to it and you dive in. You dive in and you do a little bit, and then it's uncomfortable, like you said, and you recoil. We're a little bit addicted to comfort zones now, and I get that. You know, I can only speak to my lifetime, obviously, but you know, with the chaos we all feel right now, I think it's been a good time to be a vice lately.
yeah.
But I want to ask you one that's maybe kind of loaded and one that's kind of fun, and then we can get you out of here. My kind of loaded one is you've seen multiple sides of the coin. Lots of people go on one side or the other, or once they get to one side of the coin, they completely denounce having been on the other one. You have a pretty good breadth of knowledge and a wonderful breadth of experience, it sounds like. If you could think of one thing that would be pivotal in changing some of the brokenness that we're riddled with now, en masse, what would be one of the things you think we could do to kind of relieve ourselves from some of that?
That is a good loaded question. Well, what's interesting is if you hear some of the biggest cultural leaders in our world talk about problems en masse and that aren't even spiritual per se, I've heard people like Elon Musk say things like, I mourn the Christian culture or the values that underpinned culture that helped keep a lot of things together. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I don't know that he believes, I don't know that he's a Christian, but there was a set of frameworks and he listed a few of them, like the idea of a forgiveness, a redemption, an atonement. And he says, I miss that there was a culture that we all kind of connected to like that. And so for me, I'm like, man, you're so close. Because to me, it's like the real thing is what would really do that. And I do. So, but let's take that aside. I think that one of the great things we've experienced is international, you know, the world's become smaller thanks to the internet, thanks to being online, thanks to all kinds of things. We have a cultural cross-contamination that has made things very interesting.
Right.
There is a detriment in a lot of our culture by eliminating, I think, a lot of the underpinnings of faith. We have also drifted, like, what are our common values? We hold almost nothing in common value together. Like, when even, like, people come to the U.S., it's cool that we have, like, little Italy, we have little pockets, and we love all those cultures. But where is the sort of common bond? Where's the, whether bonds of country, bonds of faith? And I think that's a thing. Like even like so it's I don't know how to fix it. I'm just saying the dichotomy of tech, for example. Like
right.
When I was growing up, we were barbarians with television. You had to sit and watch 9 p.m. ABC or what it's 9:30. And if you missed it, you had to hope they replayed a rerun before the end of the season. Like you know, or maybe you recorded it or whatever. But now, there's so many channels, there's so many non-traditional podcasts, there's so many non-traditional things that we don't have very many common things. Like everyone then would talk about, hey, did you see that show last night? Yeah, like the whole
right.
world. And so we had a common thing. So we don't all go to church. We don't all go to, we don't watch the same things.
We don't even see the same episode of Seinfeld anymore.
No, we don't see the same episode of Seinfeld. So what are we coming together around the cultural underpinnings of sort of Christianity that I understand we were never, say, fully Christian nation, but there was a sort of culture that kind of brought ideas, redemption, things like that into there. So I feel like our blessing is our curse in a lot of ways. We have a lot of interesting, cool things, but we have a lot of things that are maybe holding us back. So I will say back to the thought with Elon, I loved his thought that one of the things that we suffer from today is a lack of sometimes redemptive process. And I don't just mean in the faith. I mean, obviously in the faith, but in culture, I'm glad we're moving away from, we got to a period where, oh, I disagree with this person politically or culturally. Let's cancel that person. Let's get rid of that person. And I think that's one of the destructive things that happen because at 100%. The end of the day, people do dumb, bad things, but I still believe in redemption. Like, there has to be a path, even if it's not a religious redemption. Can that person change? Can that it doesn't mean they shouldn't experience consequence. It doesn't mean they shouldn't, you know, if you say something stupid, have whatever backlash, but you get that. So I think there needs to be pathways of redemption and opportunities for people to be more open. And sorry, you got me on this. This is a big thing.
Yeah.
This is a big thing for me. One of the things that I think has come to a detriment, and we need to overcome it, and I hope we will, is politics. And what I mean is when we grew up, people were always, they had politics. They had, you know, Democrats, Republicans. They were always a thing. People always had their opinions. But I never saw someone base their identity on politics, the core of who they are, the way they do today. I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a Green Party, I'm whatever it is, I'm a libertarian. It's to their core. And to me, that has replaced religion, and I don't think for the better. And so, for example, when we look at why our culture is also so divided, it's because the partisan wedge. Like, I love people that think differently than me, that have different beliefs on how the world should be run. We might, again, get heated, we might argue, I might think they're dumb about a certain issue, but I respect that they're actually intelligent people, that I care about them, that they're good people.
That we're on the same team.
We're on the same team. And what happened is when that culture was going wild, and I think it's pulling back a little bit, thank God, there was such pressure like, hey, if you're a celebrity, we need you to use your platform to push a political agenda.
Right.
Churches were even pushed. We rejected that at our church. We are apolitical. Any party you come, we're not pushing political parties because I think it's the most divisive thing. I'll tell you a funny moment where I cheered like crazy at Gillette Stadium. I never actually saw a Patriots game, but I saw Metallica play there a few years ago. Big fan of Metallica, right? And so I was there. James Hetfield gets up and he's like, "Hey, how many of you guys like rock and roll?" And everyone's like, "Yeah," you know, going crazy. Yeah. "How many of you guys like Metallica?" And everyone's going nuts. He's like, "Great." And he's like, "I don't care if you eat meat, you don't eat meat. I don't care who you voted for, who you're sleeping with. We're here bonded over music to have a good time.
Yes.
Let's roll." And he played. Now you look and say, that's not profound, but it is in a sense of what he was saying is, we are not going to sell ourselves out to a platform or an agenda of social, political, whatever. It's a safe place, just like we tried to create in our church. It's a safe place where you can come. I don't care about any of that stuff, where you can gather. And I think that we as a culture need to get back to that place where the public square can be dominated by lots of different beliefs and opinions, and you still have a common core of care for your brother. I mean, maybe that sounds naive, but I think the political identity has become just a virus in our culture.
Yeah, tolerance has gone out the window, and we got to get some of that back. I'm with you there.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the environment we're trying to create here. So I very much resonate with you in that way.
Awesome.
Okay, so here's your fun one. Here's your easy one. If I gave you 10,000 billboards tomorrow to put all across the United States, and they all got to have one saying, one sentence, one something on it that you could share with everybody across the country, what's the one thing you want to say?
This is going to be a selfless promotion, man.
But, yeah, that's all good with me. It's your question. It's your fun one.
They would say restofyourshow.com or therestofyourshow.com. And because I'm so excited about the book that I've written, and it shares a lot about my journey through brokenness, transformation, and offering practices that I think can help other people. And it would be a way to quickly kind of help people navigate through some of the things, some of my experience that we've been talking about, and experience that. So that's something that I'm super pumped about. And I'd get to talk to them about a lot more things that I care about through that process of engaging with them as they engage with the book, the website, and everything else. But I guess that's what I'd want. That's the thing I'm excited about.
I was
going to
say, that's a clever answer. Use your one sentence to send them to all your sentences.
Exactly. Because when I get into there, I can get into all the other stuff.
I love it. Well, Bill, I'm so grateful that we got to do this impromptu interview here. And I can't thank you enough for sharing your experience, sharing your time with us. And we'll definitely have the link below to your book. Everybody get out there and check out some of Bill's wisdom. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Eric. Great meeting you. I'll dress better next time.
Yeah, you're good.